This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the current edition of The New Yorker, there's a cartoon in which a lawyer is saying to his client, "What we're going to say to the jury is, love the embezzler, hate the embezzlement." Many people think of the cartoons as their favorite part of The New Yorker. My guest, Robert Mankoff, has been the magazine's cartoon editor since 1997. He got the job 20 years after he sold his first cartoon to The New Yorker. Mankoff has edited several collections of the magazine's cartoons, including its 75th anniversary collection. He's also the founder and editor of the internet cartoon database, The Cartoon Bank. Now Robert Mankoff has a new book called The Naked Cartoonist about the art and craft of cartooning. Robert Mankoff, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe your most famous cartoon.
All right. Well, here is my most famous cartoon. It's quite simple, and maybe that accounts for its fame. There's a guy on the phone. He's an executive, clearly a busy executive. He's pointing to his Rolodex, and he's got his phone to his ear, and he's saying, "No, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you?" I know from statistics assiduously compiled that's my favorite cartoon, because that's the one people license the most, that's the one they buy prints of, and that's the one when I'm at a party and they say, "You know what cartoon of yours I like best?" And I say, I do know what it is, and I tell them that, and I'm right.
Why do you think it struck a chord?
I think it was in 1993, and it seemed to sort of symbolize just that, the hectic, harried nature of our lives, where we're constantly meeting and associating with people which we often don't want to associate with, and we're trying to obfuscate and say the polite thing, and this somehow was really saying what people were really thinking on some of these phone calls.
You know, songwriters are always asked what comes first, the words or the music. So talking to you, the cartoonist, I am curious if the words always come first, or sometimes you get the picture first and then you have to figure out what to say with it.
With me, it's the music. Oh, I forgot.
Right.
I'm not
yeah.
I'm not a songwriter. It's, you know, as you would imagine, it can be either one, or sometimes it's an amalgam. It's half of a word, half of a picture, and then during the process of drawing or thinking, they both sort of come together. I don't know if I've exactly answered the question, but it's almost any conceivable variant of the process can occur.
You became the cartoon editor of The New Yorker in 1997. Why don't you just describe what the job is?
It's an interesting job. It's not, I guess, what people think. Often when I go around and I give talks or people find out I'm a cartoon editor, they said, "Well, that's the greatest job in the world." Imagine it, that it's something like, I don't know, being a candy taster, you know, or eating all the best food, you know, the food you really love. And it's a great job because I love cartoons, but the process by which, well, I'll give you for an example, like on a normal week, I will see 34 or 40 contributors to the magazine who do cartoons. And I'll see cartoons that unsolicited and solicited cartoons, you know, by mail. I might look at 1,000 cartoons in 2 days. So when I'm looking at the cartoons, it's probably taking me about 10 seconds or less to look at each cartoon. And at that point, just in a preliminary way, decide, do we want to use it? Do I like it? Is there something there? And then I'm going to go back and look at them again. But I'm not laughing, or almost rarely. I'm sort of just processing. There's so much to look at. And if I went on sort of some sort of gut instinct, like, am I laughing at the cartoon? Well, it would be sort of like if you were tasting bonbons and you were trying to judge them and you were saying, "Gee, this 1,000th bonbon, why doesn't it taste as good as the 5th? It wouldn't make any sense. So I try to bring some sort of principles to just the initial selection of the cartoons. Then after I make a selection out of about 1,000 of maybe 50 cartoons that I then take in an art meeting and I show to David Remnick, and we have baskets, yes, no, and maybe. And then David and I, and sometimes
he's the editor of The New Yorker.
The editor of The New Yorker, basically choose the cartoons. And in the end, David chooses them. He's got to pick out of these bunch which ones he thinks makes overall sense for the magazine. And we have differences of opinion. And, sometimes he gives in to me, but he's usually the editor, so he usually gets his way.
So you have to have criteria because, as you said, the 1,000th bonbon isn't as tasty as the first. So what are your criteria? Could you put it into words?
Sure. Or I can draw a picture, but you couldn't see it. So, although I like this whole idea of sort of the radio cartoon network where I talk cartoons. And a laugh track might be helpful, too. Well, the first criteria I have for the cartoon is it communicating some idea through the medium of humor? Is it demonstrating, you know, not just funniness, but thinking? Is it making some point? And, of course, we do cartoons that are just silly and just funny. But overall, I think the enduring nature of the New Yorker cartoons is that they strike a chord in someone. People remember them because they make some sort of point. So I'm looking for that, the communication of an idea. Secondly, if it's someone who's new, I'm looking, do they have a distinctive voice? You know, are they doing their own cartoons, or are they, you know, did they basically see a Raj Chass cartoon and think, oh, I can do Raj Chass cartoons? And then thirdly, whether or not how funny the cartoon is not, to me, always the ultimate criteria. Is, for example, if a cartoon is on a topic that's been beaten to death, then it's got to be very funny. While if it's on some topic that's never been discussed before for the first time, then as far as I'm concerned, I'll say, well, yeah, let's use this cartoon. No one has ever done a cartoon about the fact that men don't like hair on their back or whatever it is.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Mankoff. He is a cartoonist, and he's the cartoon editor for The New Yorker magazine. He has a new book called The Naked Cartoonist. When you first became the cartoon editor at The New Yorker, were you in the position of editing people who had been your heroes and sometimes being even in the position of having to reject their work?
Yeah, I was in that position and also in the position of editing and having to accept and reject the work of my friends as well. And that is a difficult situation. It occurred with the previous cartoon editor, Lee Lorenz, who is still a cartoonist and was a cartoonist when he was cartoon editor, as well. But, I mean, in the end, you have to decide either to do the job or not. And what I tell everybody, and whether really they're my friend or a longtime contributor or really no matter how famous, is that it's a cliche, but it's the work that counts.
What's the editing process like? Do you work with cartoonists on improving the work or, making it funnier, changing the drawing?
Well, very little, because one of the things is that the cartoonists submit 10 or 15 ideas every week. And it's a little bit like a type of haiku, you know what I mean? You can fiddle with it a little bit, but one of the things especially that's evolved in the New Yorker cartoon is this idea of authenticity. The cartoons, I would say, I mean, everything else in the magazine goes through a very, very elaborate editing process where things get written and rewritten, and of course it's still the person's work, but there's often a lot of hands in it. Here, when you're looking at Roz Chast's cartoon, it's Roz Chast. Nobody else wrote the line for her. Every once in a while, I'll make a suggestion, like with someone like Roz, if there's many panels, I'll say something like, I think panel 4 is weak. I think you could do a little bit more. It's more of encouragement. The people are very talented, and they want to come up with their ideas. In a caption, let's say, 10 or 15 words, yeah, we'll change a word, but I don't want to really start rewriting it because then it becomes my work. And one of the things about the New Yorker cartoon, and when you're looking at it, it says, is it's really the work of the person who does it. The editing, I think, primarily is in the selection and really in the criteria. It was very different at one time. When the magazine started out in the 30s and 40s, there was a lot more, not so much editing, but it's straight-out gag writing. People like Peter Arno, for the most part, didn't write any of their captions, or Helen Hokanson, very, very few. So it might be one writer, it might be more like sort of a Broadway show model where someone does the music and someone, does the lyrics.
So someone would come up with the gag and then the cartoonist would be brought in to come up with the image?
Yeah, but more collaborative than that. But
they worked
as
teams.
But the roles were clearly assigned. Helen Hogenson might draw pictures and talk with her collaborator, and he might come up with lines, and they might go back and forth. But it was different than it is now.
My guest is Robert Mankoff, cartoon editor of The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Naked Cartoonist. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is cartoonist Robert Mankoff. He's the cartoon editor of The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book, The Naked Cartoonist. Who were some of your heroes when you were reading The New Yorker before you started working there?
Well, I, like everybody else, Charles Adams and George Price, but I would say my main influence, although my cartoon certainly veered very, very far away from it, was Saul Steinberg. There was something so, and it was hard to say even that they were cartoons, but there was something sort of so deeply intellectual about those cartoons, and I had quit graduate school to become a cartoonist, so Saul Steinberg was sort of my way station.
Can you give an example of one of his cartoons that influenced you?
Well, I think I'm trying to remember it. He engaged in this wonderful sort of, almost fake writing, very elaborate writing. And there's a guy at quite simple cartoon. It's a loan office, and there's a this guy asking for the loan, and in the speech balloon that's coming out is all this elaborate writing, but it's all just shaped like a no. Almost like the Constitution.
Right.
But in this wonderful, and also very, very artistic as well. And the elaborate pictures that really can't be summarized on the radio would just sort of spark my imagination and think, I guess what it made me think is that this was something you could aspire to, that something wonderful could be done in this field, that it could be more than just a joke or more than, I had grown up drawing Donald Duck and Bugs Bunny in school, and it could sort of be... I quit graduate school, and I said, well, gee, The New Yorker could sort of be the Harvard of cartooning.
Now, you sold your first cartoon to The New Yorker in 1977. What were
right.
some of the things that you drew before that didn't get in, that got your rejection notices?
Yeah, I did hundreds of cartoons, and I actually got a number of them published. I'm thinking of some of them now. One of them is it's in the book. It shows a jester, and he's in a very gloomy cell. He's hanging by his hands, and he's peering out the window to the guard. And it's a court jester, and he's saying, "Please tell the king I've remembered the punchline."
Yeah, I like that one.
then there's a couple, a middle-aged couple. They're just reading the paper in the living room. And you see in the picture says it's not someone's knocking at the door, and the woman is saying to the man, "Quick, hide! That may be my husband."
That's a kind of variation on the no sex theme.
Right, it is. Yeah, yeah, it is. And when I look back on this, I mean, sometimes I flip that around, where you take a situation that is a very, very common situation, and then by somehow looking at it in a different way, like I might have a couple just at breakfast reading the paper, drinking coffee, and the woman might be saying, "Dave, I think the divorce has just been a little bit too amiable."
Of the rejection letters that you got when you were starting out, which is the one that really stands out in your mind?
Well, none of the New Yorkers, because this was the standard rejection slip. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to see it, which, as I said, many people, not just me, created wallpaper out of. The one that stands out in my mind is one I got from Steve Heller, who was then, I think, the editor for the op-ed page of the New York Times, where they used art, the art editor, a cartoon historian and a fine editor and everything. But I got back this little note that said, "We think your ideas are good, but we would like you to do them in a less cumbersome style." So, which I ignored. I persisted in my cumbersome style, but I think that's the one that I sort of remember.
Did you know what he meant by cumbersome style?
Yeah, because I've done the stuff with the dots. Uh-huh. He wanted me to lose the dots. And I didn't know then why I did the, you know, did this stipple dot style. I don't exactly know why, except probably I'd been drawing this way in one way or another since high school. So there was something about that rejection letter that I sort of liked in a way, because it was asking me to do something that I knew I wasn't going to do. And so it sort of gave me, said, okay, well, I'm going to have to see if I can do it, you know, my way without the whole melodic interpretation Sinatra thing.
Now, in talking about rejection notices, in your new book, The Naked Cartoonist, you reprint a letter you got from David Mamet shortly after you became cartoon editor, and then you print the note you sent him in return.
Right.
So read us the two.
Well, David Mamet, I'll do this from memory. I think it's pretty
close. This is David Mamet, the screenwriter and playwright
and
director.
Right, the screenwriter. Well, and cartoonist, I guess, because he did cartoons, and I think he has published some cartoons. He sent me, he said, when I became cartoon editor, Dear Mr. Mankoff, congratulations on becoming cartoon editor. I've taken the liberty of sending you a bunch of cartoons. And I looked at them, and I wrote him back this note saying, thanks very much. I've taken the liberty of sending you a play.
Why did you do that?
Just snottiness, but partly.
Because it's really a way of saying to him, you may be a great writer, but your cartoons aren't very good. I mean,
let's put it more gently, not right for us. That's what I learned basically in being an editor. You don't say things are not good. You say they're not right for us.
Right.
There is a certain arrogance that writers have, often captured when they say this to you. I can't draw at all, but their assumption is somehow that they could easily, you know, create great cartoons because they're smart, they're writers, they're funny, and whatnot. And I haven't found it to be the case. Now, last week, Norman Mailer was in my office showing me his cartoons. And I must say, I was a lot nicer to Mr. Miller than I was in this note to David Mamet, but they weren't actually cartoons, so I don't know if they didn't really fit the criteria so much, whereas actually David Mamet's cartoons were basically attempts to do gag cartoons, and I mean, I judged them as unsuccessful. Others might think otherwise. I think the problem writers have, and even, you know, great writers, is that they bring all, it's almost like a tremendously muscle-bound person trying to play ping pong. They're just bringing too much to it.
Mm-hmm.
They want to show off. They want to show not only are they funny, but they're smart. The other thing that happens, I don't know how to describe this, but even if their cartoons were okay, it would be hard to use them because the cartoons are become too contaminated by their other persona, so that people couldn't really even see the cartoon. The way I'd explain it is sort of by flipping it and say, let's say you look at Rozchak's cartoons, and if you look at them for 20 years, and these wonderful cartoons, and then you meet Rozchak. Well, it's hard for you just to meet Roz. You're looking at her, but you're not even seeing her, or you're seeing her, but it's somehow contaminated by all your preconceptions about her because of her cartoons. In the same way, if someone was, you know, very famous, let's say George Bush started submitting cartoons to the New Yorker, it would be impossible just to view them as they should be viewed. I mean, if they were funny enough, I guess we'd publish it. And I am, and even right now over the radio, encouraging George Bush to submit.
Well, who knows?
I know he's a busy guy, but look, get off the treadmill, draw a little bit.
Robert Mankoff is the cartoon editor of The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Naked Cartoonist. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Mankoff, cartoon editor of The New Yorker magazine. He got the job in 1997, 20 years after he sold his first cartoon to The New Yorker. He's edited several collections of the magazine's cartoons. Now he has a new book about the art and craft of cartooning called The Naked Cartoonist. In a recent edition of The New Yorker, there is a cartoon that it's very funny. I thought I'd ask you about it. As our listeners may know, there's a new Museum of Sex in New York, and this cartoon showed exhibits from the Museum of No Sex, and the exhibits included the chastity belt, the headache, the pocket protector, Star Trek memorabilia, and late night television. Talk about deciding to use this particular comic.
Well, I mean, I think, in a way, it's sort of like a common way to flip an idea. And another criteria really that I didn't mention is topicality. A cartoon like this, simply because it talks about this new subject, in a way, doesn't have to be the world's best cartoon. It just sort of interestingly flipped the idea of sex with no sex. I mean, one of the things that changed somewhat in The New Yorker, especially when Tina Brown started being editor, was that sex became a topic. One of the first cartoons I did when Tina became editor for her tenure was, there was a couple, a middle-class couple in bed, and they're reading, and the woman is saying, you're right, tonight isn't reading night, tonight is sex night.
Right.
And in a way, both these cartoons have an affinity. One of the things is that, in sort of a subtextual way, this cartoon speaks to the fact that although we have a very sexualized culture, people aren't having much sex.
Well, you have another cartoon about that, and it's there's four middle-aged people in a living room, one sitting on the couch, one's on an easy chair, another's on another easy chair, one's reading, one's listening to a Walkman, the other's knitting.
Right.
And what's the caption?
I think it's Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, the remake.
Yeah. And for anyone who doesn't know that movie, that's a movie about, like, swinging couples having sex with each other in the 60s or 70s, I forget which. So, yeah, I thought that was another funny one on that same theme, not having sex.
Not having sex. And this is a little bit what I'm talking about as we're discussing these cartoons. You can see what the sort of bedrock criteria for what has become defined as a New Yorker cartoon is. It's topical, but it's not today topical. It's not this week topical. It's contemporary, but it is speaking to the issues of this time.
Can you think of funny ones about having sex?
About having sex. Let me say, I think I did a cartoon where there's a few cartoons. One I did where there's a woman and a man in bed, and they're actually having sex, New Yorker type sex. and sometimes I ask my wife, "You want to have New Yorker type sex or regular sex?" But the woman is saying to the man, "Wow, our first date, and already I feel like it's our second.
Right.
So the other thing I did, somewhat crazy sort of sex thing, is I did a cartoon where it's just two chairs stacked up, you know, like when you close a restaurant with one chair on top of the other, and it's called How Chairs Have Sex.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Mankoff. He's the cartoon editor for The New Yorker magazine, and he has a new book called The Naked Cartoonist. One of the things you've been doing at The New Yorker the past few years is having a captioning contest. Why don't you describe the contest?
The contest is, it happens every cartoon issue where we provide an image drawn by a cartoonist. When the cartoonist draws the image, he doesn't have any idea, or he doesn't have a completely thought out idea of what the caption is actually going to be. And then we ask the readers of the magazine, this year we've done it all over the internet, to supply a caption. And the idea is somehow it's a little bit like a parlor game. It's like, it's not so much, well, can you make a great cartoon out of this, but can you really make any cartoon? It's quite hard because you, as the reader, don't have control over the picture at all. When I'm a cartoonist, I can draw a situation, and I can discard all the drawings that don't work until, you know, one sort of hits my mind is right. I mean, I can start drawing a couple, and I can have the couple on either side of a couch, then I can put guns in their hand, and I can have them shooting at each other, and I can have the guy on the phone while this couple is shooting each other, and he's on the phone and saying, as a matter of fact, you did call us at a bad time. But I get to control all the elements to make that gag work. So it's harder, and that's why I think it's quite remarkable that the readers of the magazine come up with some pretty good lines for the weird pictures that we throw at them.
You want to describe the picture that was in the most recent version of this in 2002?
Yeah, it's got it's a prison cell, sort of hard-bitten prisoner, and on the lower bunk is an angel who is very sad, and he's got his head in his hands in a woe-begone look. And that's sort of the picture, and the idea is that this picture should create some sort of tension. I mean, what is an angel doing in prison? Is it an angel? He's got a little, you know, and there's all little objects, this little pin-up picture. The convict is talking to the angel. And the question is, you know, what is it that he's going to say that's going to be funny?
As we record this, you haven't picked a winner yet. Can
right.
you tell what some of the lines you're considering, or at least some of the lines that have come in are?
Sure. One of them is a convict, you know, talking to the angel and saying, I think I could borrow that outfit for the parole meeting. There's a couple of long lines of, yeah, the devil made me do it, too. or some guardian angel you turned out to be.
All right.
Just for discussion's sake, how far do you think you could carry a guy?
That's good.
And
are these contenders or?
Yeah, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And they're quite good.
Yeah.
They're quite good. And I in one way, it points out to the great readers of the magazine. And it also points out why the cartoons are this democratic form, because people really can relate to them. You often can come up with a good line for a cartoon. Maybe not, you know, in a professional way. Maybe if you had to do 10 or 20 a week, you know, you wouldn't be able to do it. But people feel, a natural connection to cartoons because they think, sometimes realistically, sometimes unrealistically, that they could do them.
After September 11th, how long did it take The New Yorker to feel like it was comfortable or that it was appropriate to publish cartoons that had to do with terrorism?
I think we took a week where we just stepped back. We had one George Booth drawing, which wasn't a cartoon, sort of an anti-cartoon, just showed one of his usually gay, happy figures depressed. Miss Ritterhouse, she had her violin, but she wasn't playing any music, and the cat just had his head between his hands. But the week after, we sort of edged back into it. The first cartoon we ran after September 11th was a woman saying to a guy at a bar, I never thought I'd laugh again until I saw that jacket. And it showed wonderfully. It showed wonderfully, really well. We were going to laugh. People were going to be silly and stupid. And then there was a great cartoon, which is still applicable, is that woman getting on a plane with a cat and a little cat carrier, and a security guy saying, "Ma'am, we're going to have to declaw the cat."
That's good.
So I think we did a pretty good job. Of course, it wasn't about, we didn't do cartoons about the tragic part of it. We did cartoons about the human part and what we were after September 11th, which were still people.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. Thanks for having me. It was really my pleasure. Whenever you get to New York, come and visit me at The New Yorker. I'd love to show you the place.
I'm glad you said that because I have a few cartoons I wanted to show you. I'm kidding. Don't worry. Don't worry.
And I have a few interviews, of course, I'd like to do.
Robert Mankoff is the cartoon editor of The New Yorker and the author of the new book, The Naked Cartoonist. This is Fresh Air.